This is Dave Schwartz, and this is the Pace Makes the Race podcast. And my guest today is Derek Simon. Say hello, Derek.
Hello.
See, he never follows instructions. Hello, Derek, but I just get hello. Before we get started, if you haven't listened to us before, Derek and I love doing these podcasts. They're a lot of fun. We do very little planning ahead of time. But before I get started, I got to tell you, the boss here is a real slave driver, and she makes me tell you that we are pacemakestherace.com. Got to spell it out. Don't forget the pacemakestherace.com. Go to our website. We've got lots of free, powerful content for you, like this stuff. And join our email list. Join our Facebook group. So, without further ado, here's Derek. Derek, what's on your agenda to talk about today? Oh, I forgot to tell the title. The title of our show. You have to understand, this is how it goes with Derek and I. We spend like an hour catching up, and then we finally decide what we're going to talk about. The topic today is four ways to absolutely find vulnerable favorites. Derek, you're up.
Right, and I figured since we've talked a little bit about that before, like, you know, the criteria needed to play a favorite, you had brought up you used the term bridge jumper. And I've said before, I think actual bridge jumping, and you meant it to mean just lower odds horses, you know.
Even money, yeah.
Correct. But I've said before that I think the actual bridge jumpers, when you have that negative show pool, is one of the best bets in racing. Simply because, you know, you can make some show bets and, you know, break even or maybe lose a little bit, but you are going to catch that one where the favorite is completely out of there. So I wanted to talk about kind of what I look for in those situations, which I think dovetails beautifully with your point in terms of looking for just, you know, very vulnerable, very low-priced horses.
So your definition of a bridge jumper, we're talking about these guys that are going off at like one to five, one to nine. I mean, is there a cutoff point or how do you define it?
Well, when I look for the actual bridge jumping, and again, this is looking at the show pool. Well, it could be any of the pools, but 75% or more of the pool. And I know that's not always necessarily negative, but it's close enough. And I especially like, if you're going to bet the show, if you're going to try to, you know, catch these bridge jumpers, look for tracks that have net pool pricing. And we will get into that on this show. But it is very important, I think, when you're looking to make some money in the show pool. But yeah, looking for those really, really strong favorites and the ones that are vulnerable.
Okay, so are you telling me you actually understand net pool pricing? I mean, not that we're going to go into it here.
Yeah, I actually wrote about it probably 3 or 4 years ago. I was intrigued by the concept, and it really is. For people who don't know how that works, it's something that you should learn and know whether your track offers it or not. Because I tell you what, I'll give you a quick story, Dave. When Zenyatta was running, of course, she generated many negative pools. So I would bet against her consistently in the show pool, even though she is not the kind of vulnerable favorite that we're going to be talking about today. But I actually made money betting against Zenyatta in the show pool, despite the fact that she never finished out of the money. And that's because of that pool pricing.
Boy, I can't wait to hear how that works. Because I truthfully admit, I mean, guys, I've been in this game a long time, and I know a lot about racing. And I can't wrap my head around net pool pricing. Show of hands, how many of you out there really get it? Yeah, there's like three people in the audience. Okay. All right. So tell us, do you actually, you make the show bets then?
Yes, yes. And in fact, I've started betting more seriously as of November, as of the start of this month. And I'm always looking for those situations. Now, the thing I would like that I don't have yet is a program that would kind of at least alert me to possibilities. You know, you'd think it would be simple. Well, you just look for the horses that are, you know, 4 to 5, 3 to 5 in the line. It doesn't always work that way. And in fact, when the horse is not 4 to 5 or 3 to 5 on the line, those are some of the best situations. And certain tracks, you see it more often. Believe it or not, Mountaineer is a track where you see a lot of negative pools, and it's a great place to, you know, bet into those show pools.
Okay, I'm going to add something. I had a conversation. There's a guy on our Facebook group, and I know you know him too. He posts under the name Mark David. And Mark and I had a conversation a week or so ago. And this, truthfully, I mean, his paradigm for handicapping is way different than mine. Well, no, it really isn't. It's just that I do it all with metrics. And I was shocked when I talked to this guy about how similar his handicapping approach is to mine, despite the fact that he really doesn't use lots and lots of numbers like I do, and certainly not systematic. He's methodical. But I talk about this guy. First of all, he's really an intelligent guy, so much so that I want to do a podcast with him in a couple of weeks. But he talked about what you're talking about, Derek. And specifically, he said the same thing that you said. He said there's a handful of tracks that really produce these bridge jumpers. And get this, he charts them statistically to become an expert on them.
I love that.
Do you do any of that?
I will look. No, I don't. See, and that's what I need to do. I would look forward to that podcast. And actually, I know him too, so it'd be interesting to hear how he goes about that. I've said before, and you know, that's one thing I love about talking to you, Dave, because we've both been in the game for a long time, but we're not afraid to admit that we don't know things. I mean, this is so rare in our game. Everybody knows everything. I am not good at predicting odds. I never have been. I don't know why. You would think somebody who's done so much stuff with fair odds and value and database that I would have a good idea. I don't. And so for me, sometimes these show pools develop, and I'm thinking, why in the world would anybody bridge jump on that horse? Those are the greatest opportunities. But again, it doesn't help when you notice it was 0 minutes to post, you know, and you're rushing to try to get that bet in.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I guess I've never taken it seriously because I don't like being a scrambler. I mean, I only need about 3 minutes, 4 minutes in a race. It's all automated. It's relatively automated. I shouldn't say all automated, but it's all systematic. But I don't want a ground squirrel. And so back on topic, though. So you're looking. You actually, do you punch the numbers in? You only need the two numbers. You need the amount of money wagered on the horse and the total amount in the show pool, and you're looking for 75% or more. Mark actually said 80%, but I don't want to steal his. You know, we should do a show with the three of us.
Yeah, that would actually be good, and I would have no qualms with 80% because that's when you're truly getting negative. 75% is not always the case, but usually it'll be enough to boost up those show prices, and it's just a nice number to look for. It's a little bit easier, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. I don't know.
So what's your strategy? What do you do?
Well, the first thing, and again, this would apply to heavily bet favorites as well. So I'm actually going to start with what I think is probably the key point, and that's a lack of experience. And let me explain what I mean by that. It's not necessarily that the horse hasn't raced much, although that's certainly a good way of going about it. But it's just basing a horse's ability or your assessment of their ability on very little evidence. And this is, you know, something I think that can be applied to handicapping as a whole. So many people look at a horse, let's say with one start, and yeah, it looked impressive. But how many times do we see that horse that, you know, started one time, wired the field, great speed figure? We don't know what that horse is going to do if it faces pace pressure. We don't know what that horse is going to do if it can't get the lead. And so when people bet these kinds of horses as though they're absolute world beaters, especially in the show pool, it's a great time to go against them because we've seen over and over again that many of these need the lead types. If they don't get that lead, if they don't get that desired trip, not only do they not win, but they don't hit the board. And so some of my greatest bets have been against these kinds of horses. In fact, it was I'm going to forget the year, but the Withers a few years ago, there was a massive favorite in there. I bet three horses to show. Those three horses finished in the show pool, and it was just astronomical payoffs on them.
Okay, so give me any. First of all, by the way, are we usually talking about small fields?
I would say, as a general rule, that is true. That you know, the bridge jumpers come out to bet to show in smaller fields. That's true.
Well, and so you're looking at races where you've got a very lopsided show pool, and then you're basically hoping the bridge jumper falls out of the money.
Correct. And the beautiful thing about betting the show, again, especially if it's net pool pricing, is a lot of times you can still make money if the horse is in the money. Because, again, it's the dynamics of the way those show prices are determined. Well, all the secondary prices. So that's the reason I like it so much. But I know that, you know, you were looking at it from a broader perspective. So this would apply to heavily bet horses as well. Because most of the time, if the horse is being bet heavily to show, it's well under even odds, usually in that 2-5, 1-5 range. Mm-hmm. So, again, this would apply for those horses as well. The advantage of betting the show is that you get a little bit of comfort in the sense that if the big horse does win or the big favorite does win, you can still cash. Obviously, if you're betting to win, that's not going to be the case. But I would still say that if you see a horse that doesn't have a lot of experience, you're not basing its ability on a lot of data, you know, taking 1-5, 1-9, these kinds of prices don't make a lot of sense.
Okay, well, first of all, we are going to have to do a show on net pool pricing because, I can't imagine you have a winner that pays $210 in the show pool and that's a good thing for somebody else. So you're going to have to explain that, and I know it's outside our scope today. Let me ask you this. You mentioned we started with lack of experience. Tell me, and does that mean lightly raced? Does it mean... if this is a turf race, does it mean may have a lot of races but lightly raced on the turf?
Well, actually, I'll give an example, and I'm going to give an example of a losing bet in the Breeders' Cup. And I had a really good Breeders' Cup, but one of the races I was wrong about was the Breeders' Cup Classic. And my thinking with the Classic is...
Wait a minute. You were wrong?
Believe it or not, Dave, yeah. That happens in racing sometimes.
To Derek Simon?
Never. Well, wait, never on social media, ever. Everybody
okay,
on
okay.
Social media.
That's fair enough.
This is a race I was wrong about. In fact, it's funny, I did a video about it, and I haven't looked recently, but invariably when I'm wrong on one of these videos, I always get somebody telling me how stupid I was. So I'm looking forward to those. And then it's kind of frustrating. Like I said, I had a great Breeders' Cup. I choose to do the video on the race I was wrong about.
Ego problems. Yeah, that's what you got.
Yeah. it's funny because I've said that over and over again. And in fact, this doesn't relate specifically to the topic, but it does to winning at the racetrack. That is one thing as a player that you have got to get a handle on and got to get rid of. If you are so worried about being right or having people think you're right and think you're great, I don't think you stand a chance in this game. I've got no issues whatsoever with being wrong. It's going to happen more often than not. And if you can't handle that, probably not the game to be playing. But anyway, back to the Breeders' Cup Classic. I felt that Arrogate, that the bulk of the betting on Arrogate was going to be on his Travers, which was a sensational performance. And here's the funny thing with this, too. From the standpoint of the figures that I produce, Arrogate looks like a superstar. But in the betting in the Breeders' Cup Classic, I like California Chrome. He was strong. He was solid. Arrogate, you had to accept that Travers as being his ability. If you took that race away, he's not a big favorite. He's certainly not the odds that he went off in the Breeders' Cup Classic. And that was my reason for betting against him. In this case, it didn't. Oh, and then I also knew that he was going to be coming off the pace and probably further off the pace than he ever had in his career. Now, I knew that Bob Baffert had been training him to do this, but we hadn't seen it in a race yet. We hadn't seen that he could be successful in a race coming from far off the pace. Those are the kinds of situations that I'm looking for when I'm betting against a big favorite. Again, there's going to be times when the horse surprises you or is just better than you thought or just better on that day than you thought. But in the long run, you're going to be better off playing against big favorites when you have a situation where they're trying to do something that they haven't proven that they can do before. Again, because you're trying to beat a big favorite. I've said over and over again, if the horse is a long shot, if instead of 1-9, it's 19-1, all of those rules don't apply. But when you've got a big favorite, they've got to meet a lot of different, you know, obviously more stringent criteria because you're getting less money on them.
Okay. Now, so if I'm hearing you right, what you're saying is you didn't bet Arrogate because basically from your handicapping point of view, he was a one-trick pony. That is, he'd only had one really overwhelmingly good race. So would it be safe to say that even worse than that would be a horse that had not ever done what he was being asked to do today? Because that's like, I got zero legs to my table, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, if it's a horse that has nothing that's going to meet, you know, what you're looking for in this race, that would be an even worse bet. Because Arrogate, you know, honestly, even in terms of our discussion, is a little bit on the outside of what we're talking about, because I want to say that he was 8-5 in the Breeders' Cup Classic. And we're, of course, talking about big favorites. But the principle, it was a horse I knew a lot of people could relate to because, you know, we watched the Breeders' Cup Classic. So the principle is the same. But in terms of the odds, obviously, if Arrogate's 1-9 or you know, 1-5, that's exactly what you're looking for. And if he's done nothing, he's showed no ability at all, which was the case of when I used the Withers as an example, the favorite in that race didn't look like he could go that distance of ground effectively. That's the ideal situation to bet against those kinds of horses.
So you were questionable about Arrogate to begin with, because his history wasn't that great.
Arrogate, in fact, on my figures, looks sensational. So that's why, like I said, it was a little bit different. However, if you look at the Travers, it was so far above what he'd done before that with any kind of regression, you had to question, you know, where he would rank in that field. And again, looking mostly at California Chrome, because the rest of the field wasn't that great. I mean, most people looked at that as a two-horse race.
Yeah.
But again, the general principle is if I'm going to, because you know, for, you know, the odds aren't there in a vacuum. People are going to bet based on what the horse has done. And my point is if you take away that one race, suddenly he's not 8-5. He's probably not 2-1. He's probably not 5-2. That's the kind of situation that I'm looking for. Take away the one race and how good is this horse? And so that's where I say lack of experience. If a horse doesn't have a lot of, you know, fantastic performances or performances that would justify its odds today, those are the kinds that you want to typically bet against.
So in that race, was Chrome the bridge jumper horse?
No, I would say, well, there was no bridge jumper horse because the odds were, you know, the odds were fair. That's why I said it's not a great example for what we're talking about. It just illustrates the principle of what I'm looking for when you're going against these big favorites. Chrome was actually the favorite in that race. I want to say it, I don't know, 7-5, 6-5. He might have been even odds or below even odds. And then Arrogate was the huge second choice. And then you had a bunch of horses at longer odds.
Okay. So, in other words, that has nothing to do with our discussion. Okay.
Here's the tough thing about, I got to tell people, this is the tough thing about talking today. Dave is incredibly knowledgeable, knows horse racing inside and out, but he doesn't follow current events.
No.
The Breeders' Cup, I might as well be bringing up some, you know, race in England somewhere that he's never seen.
Well, and Derek's completely right, because I'm all about the gambling side. And to me, the Derby, the Preakness, the Belmont, the Breeders' Cup, those are all such atypical racing days that I can't study them. They're, in fact, not just on Breeders' Cup Day or the Derby Day. It's not just the races at Churchill Downs I can't play. I can't play anything. Because it draws, you know, I see horse racing as a socioeconomic problem. It's an issue of how the public wagers its money. And, of course, there's also a component of predicting probabilities there. But when you get a day that is so skewed away from normal sociology, for lack of a better word, I don't know how to study it. And so I've just learned over the years. I mean, sometimes I have fun with the Breeders' Cup or the Kentucky Derby or whatever. But, you know, a week later, I've all but forgotten who was in the race. Except I do remember, what was the name of the French horse? The one that paid 250 64.
Oh, Arcangus.
Arcangus. Yeah. Arkong. Arkong.
Yeah, that's part of the way it's pronounced.
Yeah, well, I remember that one, even though I didn't bet it, because a friend of mine had that horse because he said he had a dream the night before. Or, two or three nights before, and he said a French horse burst out of the pack and won some race. And so he actually handicapped, this is a really high-level technical computer guy. And he actually said, calls me on the day before the Breeders' Cup, and he says, I have figured out who the horse is. And he bet $2 across on the horse and was just, and my phone rang. The horse is in mid stretch and he's exploded out of the pack. It's him.
Okay. Dave, it's those kinds of times when I just want to quit the game.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I've told this story before, so I mentioned a few. I remember the 2008 Kentucky Derby. And I like to get my kids involved, even though they could care less about horse racing. So, hey, you know, my daughter's little at the time. Here, honey, you know, pick the horses in the Kentucky Derby.
Maybe give them some crack. Okay, give them some crack, too, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, she said, I like mine that better, Daddy. Oh, honey, are you sure? I don't know. That horse doesn't have that much of a chance. So, I don't make the bet on my Matt Bird for her. And, of course, that's the horse that wins.
Yeah, of course. And well, and that's what happened to my friend Stuart, who with the dream, his wife woke up, they were going to the race book one day and on a Saturday, and she said, or he was going, she said, I had a dream last night, and this horse is going to win, and I want you to put $10 to win in place on this horse for me. Couldn't tell you who the horse was. And he got there, and he looked at the horse, and he says, yeah, he says, this horse can't win. There's just no way this horse can win. And he was about 30-1. And, of course, the horse burst out of the gate, went wire to wire, and paid like $37. And she was supposed to have it win placed. And he had to explain to her. She called these, by the way, rocking horse winners. I guess.
Ah, yes, from the old story, yeah.
Oh, there's a background to that?
Yes, that is actually the name of the story. I read it as a kid, and that's basically what it was, this kid who would have dreams about which horses would win. So it's a perfect title for those kinds of horses.
So wait a minute. Now, you're telling me there's like a fairy tale book for horse players?
Well, no, it's not a handicapping book. It's actually I want to say it's a classic story because, you know, I can't remember the author. I want to say it's not a U.S. Based author, but, you know, we read it in school, and obviously this wasn't a way to indoctrinate us into gambling, or at least I don't think it was. Maybe it was.
Probably Mike
Helm. Yeah, I remember that as a kid.
It was probably Mike Helm, you know, the guy who did the pedigree rates. Folks, I'm sorry. This is just looks like one of these days. There's no way we're going to get through our four items. But okay, so back on track. So how do you bet a race? You've decided that a particular race, first of all, you've decided that a particular bridge jumper horse is to some degree vulnerable. Right? That's where it starts.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
of course, he is a bridge jumper horse because he's got your 75% in the show pool. So then what do you do?
Well, if we're talking specific, and this is where it is different, depending on what you're doing. If it's a true show bet, if it's a bridge jumpers, you know, type of situation, I really look for the horses that can get in the money. And this is different from looking for a horse that can win. For example, in that Withers race, it was a case of early speed, you know, a need the lead type. And again, these are great horses to bet against. So in that case, I'm looking for horses that can close. That's why Zenyatta, from a bridge jumper standpoint, was not a great horse to bet against, because that closing style can typically get him in the money. You know, winning might be a different story. So there is a different approach. If I'm looking to bet the show, I really don't like to bet confirmed front runners in a show situation, in a bridge jumping situation, because of the tendency for them to either win or be out. I'm looking for horses that can close, horses that can press. If I'm looking just to beat the favorite, now that's a completely different story. There I might look for a front runner, you know, a different type of horse. So it is a bit different, again, based on the situation.
Okay, so if I'm keeping notes here, folks. So if I hear you right, what you're saying is if you are a negative bridge jumper, one of the things you look for is a front runner. To bet against.
Yes, to bet against, correct.
Okay, and if you're looking for a positive side to that, in other words, you have a bridge jumper race, then you look for potentially an early speed horse who could be up close throughout the race and may hang on for third or better.
Or a horse that closes if you're betting to show. If you're betting to win, yes, I would look more for, you know, more of the traditional factors in terms of winning. But to bet, in fact, some of my favorite bets to show are when you have, let's say you're betting against a horse due to lack of experience, which we already talked about, and the fact that the horse is a need-to-lead type, you think it's a contested pace, looking for that horse that's steady, maybe not the best horse in the race, but that kind of steady performer, those are some of the best bets in the show pool.
Okay. So you've got this bridge jumper race, and so now are you're picking off characteristics of who you're going to bet? Or are you just, like, if it was a six-horse field, would you just bet all five of them to show?
Or do you? No. Now, I've heard people do this, where they see the negative pool and they bet everything. Again, the way I'm looking at it is I would like to make money or at least lose less when these horses that are heavily bet finish in the money, because for the most part, they're going to. So I really prefer to go with 1 to 2 contenders. Usually it's 2. Sometimes I will go 3 if I'm more confident that the horse is going to finish out of the money. Now, I'm going to tell people right off, there have been times where I bet 2 to 3 horses, it's a negative show pool, the horse I didn't like finishes out of the money, and I don't cash.
Sure.
6-horse field, and my horses are 4, 5, and 6.
Yes.
So that does happen. But in the long run, you're better off with that. I've had many instances where the 3 horses that I played made up the top 3 and the show prices were astronomical. That Withers being an example, but there's many examples like that. Or if I'm betting 2, both of them are in the money. And this happens a lot when the horse is the big favorite wins too, so I can still cash. Certainly I wouldn't have made money with Zenyatta if I'm betting every horse in the field. So I was very specific about the horses that I chose to bet. And by the way, in those cases, I typically did look for more horses with front speed because, in fact, you could probably look at this as a general rule. If you're betting against a horse to show, you kind of want to go against whatever that horse's characteristics are.
Oh, so amen! Sing it, brother. That's right.
Right. You know, Zenyatta was a massive closer, so I'm looking for horses with more speed in those cases. So I cashed more on horses that had more speed. Like I said, I tend to like the horses, you know, that the bet against horses to be in a need to lead type, and then I'm looking more for those, you know, closers, plotters. But yeah, it'd be the opposite of whatever the horse is that you're betting against.
And you're talking about running style.
Correct.
Okay, let me introduce an idea that relates to this. And folks, for those of you who are listening, again, we didn't plan any of this out. We just find that we kind of go at it extemporously, and it seems to work. I have no idea what that word means, but at least it makes me sound smart. I just put out a product called the Chaos Race, and this is not meant as a commercial for it, because the sale's already gone by the time you hear this. But it's called the Chaos Race when handicapping will fail. And one of the things that I look for, now I don't look for bridge jumpers per se. I look for when I have a horse that looks to be a single. I handicap the race, I've got my contenders, and at the end of it I come up with one horse. I have a set of characteristics that horse has to jump through, and there's a kind of a gauntlet, if you will. Now, the example that when Derek and I were talking about this before the show, and I referred to it as you've got like 4 legs on the table, and each of those legs is like a different look at the race. For example, there's a pace scenario, there's the trainer, there's kind of the general handicapping, and so you may, I mean, it doesn't matter what your table legs are, you know, what the legs of your table are, but the point is you have multiple ways that you say, well, this horse has all four legs, so therefore I can bet him. And I don't mean that literally, the horse has four legs, but I've certainly bet a few of those that didn't. Just what we need is laughter here. Okay, but the point is, when I wind up with a horse that according to the handicapping should be a single, I don't look for the second best horse or the third best horse. In fact, I look at it as a chaos race. And again, that means to me that the handicapping is all going to break down. And so, again, it's like a great what if you have one of your bridge jumpers, for example, and you say, well, this bridge jumper is actually vulnerable. I mean, he's not the horse that, he doesn't look like he's a 98% chance of winning. He's no Secretariat in the Belmont, right? I mean, who in their right mind, even I know that name, Secretariat, yeah. I even know Penny Tweedy. But the point is, you look at that horse and it's like, how does this horse not get in the money? Or how does this horse not win? Another one that I bet many years ago was Winning Colors at Saratoga. After winning the Derby, she came back in a non-winner allowance. I don't remember, non-winners of four or whatever it was, at six furlongs. She went off at 1-2 and she was like a steal, right? I mean, how do you not bet this horse? Like, her worst speed rating was 12 lengths better than the best speed rating in the entire field. And she did, in fact, win by like 12 lengths or so. But back on track, the point is, when I look at a horse who's low odds and it looks like he should be bet, and then I find things wrong with him, I don't handicap the race. I mean, handicapping will fail. Why would I want to handicap? And that's why when you don't handicap, or you do some very rudimentary, but the most important thing is to take that horse out of the equation completely, all of a sudden, you're cashing these $80 horses, $150 horses, and stuff like that. Have you ever had experience like that?
It's so funny. You know, this is the amazing thing when I talk to you, and I didn't tell you this before the show, but since I've been betting more seriously, and my ADW just upgraded me now. I'm a different level now, so this is nice. But I've actually cashed quite a few pick threes, which has typically not been a strength for me, but I bet them more realistically recently. In other words, I'm using more combinations. I've always been a cheapskate, Dave. I try to cash on, you know, three combinations, this kind of stuff.
Gosh, look at the time. Can we really talk about this now?
This will be quick. But
no, I mean to cheapskate.
relating to the chaos thing, I was just thinking the other day how valuable it would be to know when a race is likely to produce a big price. Because again, I said at the top of this show, I'm not great at predicting prices. So a lot of times I'll go deep in races where the 4-5 favorite wins. And then it's like, it's the most frustrating thing in the world. So I agree. It's not something that I've done a lot with. You know, unfortunately, there's only so much time to do things. And I study all kinds of different things. I have not sunk a lot of time into this, but I could absolutely see the value of a product like that or anything that would help you find out, okay, this race, you don't know who's going to win necessarily, but this race is likely to produce a big payoff.
Well, and that's the whole idea. I mean, my definition of a chaos race, and not all long-priced horses are, but my races are, I mean. My definition of a chaos race is a race where handicapping or conventional handicapping is likely to fail. And there are certain things you can look for. One of them is a standalone single horse who doesn't quite have everything going for him. And that kind of fits in with your, you know, lack of experience being one of the reasons. What other reasons can you think of where you would find a bridge jumper horse that you'd have confidence at least wouldn't win the race?
Well, we already talked about the need to lead time, so I'm going to jump ahead to something we had kind of discussed before the show but didn't think we'd have time for, and I'm going to talk about horses that have dubious trainer patterns. And what do I mean by that? Because I do think that trainer handicapping gets overdone. You know, people talk about, oh, this horse looks great, this guy's 2 for 3, you know, in this particular situation. Well, that sample size is not good enough. But to give an example of something I see quite often, you have a great trainer, let's say, that claimed the horse maybe, and it's dropping in class now. A lot of trainers are great with this, but I always like to question why. Why is this horse in this spot? And through that kind of analysis, a lot of times you will find a lot of horses that they're going to look great on paper, but why are they there? You have to question these kinds of things. Now, I use the example of being claimed and dropped in class. It's just an example. But it might be, you know, something different. A horse is trying turf, or it's going to the mat. All kinds of different things like that. Ask yourself, why is this trainer doing this? And I think through that, and you know, lack of workouts, whatever the case may be, that's where you can find a lot of dubious favorites as well. And especially if the guy is generally good. Let's say it's a Todd Fletcher, but he's doing something that he's not necessarily great at. Again, question, why is this trainer doing that? And you'll find a lot of underlays that way.
Okay, this is where I use my phrase. Derek, you ignorant slut. It's Jane, you ignorant slut. Okay, first of all, no, I love what you're saying. Okay, dubious trainer patterns. I love the idea. The problem I have with it for the general public is that it's just too difficult to apply. I mean, it's a lot of work to do trainer stats, right? And to have these angles. And even if you buy them somewhere, part two of that is that you wind up with conflicting information. Now, John Burrell has done wonders with this stuff. Down the Tampa Bay guy, and I had him on a show, 2-3 years ago. And it was just one of our most popular shows ever. But the idea of building spot play angles around trainers, again, that is such a massive amount of work. And like John said, he does it with spreadsheets. He looks at the top 60, 70, 80 trainers on that circuit and literally builds up spot plays for each one. Well, he spends 6 months a year doing that without playing. Oh, that's that. I check out of that. On the other hand, the principle is great. You just have to have a way to look at it from the 50,000 or at least the 5,000 foot level, so that you've got numbers. That I'm a numbers guy, right? I mean, I want a metric, and I actually have numbers like that. I get one trainer number. Well, I actually get two or three, but they're used in different places. But we create what we call an object, a handicapping object. But there are trainer numbers. Ed Bain is a guy. You've possibly heard of his 4+30 approach. Do you know that, Derek?
I'm familiar with him. I'm not familiar with that approach.
Well, imagine he's got this huge number of statistics, and his requirement for a positive is that in this category, this trainer must have 4 wins and at least 30% winners. So in other words, a horse that is 2 for 2 has 100% winners, but it doesn't qualify because he doesn't have enough wins. So he's looking, and a horse that's 1 for 3 doesn't qualify. But a horse that was 4 for 10, well, that factor qualifies. So imagine you come up with this list of 4+30 factors, and I've found that there's a threshold number in our software. We have 147 factors for each horse, and the significant Well, we do a little bit more of it than that, but the point is we need a dominant percentage. We need a trainer that's got, loosely speaking, has about 60% of all of the 4-plus 30s in the race, and he's got to have at least like 20 of them. And the system is more specific than that. But
well,
that
I like that.
Number.
I was going to say I like that a lot because I actually in my own database handicapping, I use a formula that adjusts the percentages based on the sample size. And you mentioned John, and it's like I like John's work too. My issue, and he always gets mad at me when we have this discussion. But my issue is always sample size, and that I agree with you. I think there needs to be more, and I know that he combines a lot of different angles too, so he gets a little bit more confidence that way. Mm-hmm. What I would tell the casual player who doesn't have these stats, and keep in mind, some of the basic stats are going to be in the past performances. So you're going to get a chance to see at least some basic trainer stats. But I would tell the everyday player, or not the everyday player, the casual player, what makes sense. Look at it from the standpoint of this is a business and what makes sense for this trainer. So let's say you have a horse that was claimed for $16,000. We'll use that example I was using earlier. It's running for 10 today. Okay, that's a big class drop. But let's say the horse is moving from Emerald Downs to Charlestown. Well, guess what? Emerald Downs, the purse structure, because they don't get a lot of casino money, is going to be a lot less than at Charlestown. So maybe the purse is so much higher that it makes sense, or maybe just the class structure is different. I remember back in the day, Longacres would run these $3,200 claiming races, which you wouldn't see at the Southern California tracks. So the bottom level at Longacres was going to be a lot lower than the bottom level at some of the Southern California tracks. Now, of course, most of those Southern California tracks ran better races, but still, it's like little things like that where you're looking, does this make sense from a business decision? If it does not, I can guarantee you the Todd Pletchers, the Steve Asmussen, they're not in this business to lose money. And so there may be a reason why they're willing to take a loss on that particular horse. And again, it's those kinds of things that you're trying to pinpoint. And I think you can do it by looking at it like you would, just what is logical.
Well, yeah, except, of course, in my mind, I have to boil it down to a number, and I find that if you can throw together enough numbers, you get, if you throw together enough small samples, you get a good number, a relatively good number. On the other hand, if you, the thing I don't like about John Burrell's approach to, like you said, to get the confidence, he cherry-picks the stuff he's going to put together. And but I can't argue with the fact it seems to work for him.
Absolutely. Yeah, whatever works. And I agree with you, Dave. You and I think both agree that a data-driven approach is far superior. And I know people will argue, oh, you got to look at the horse, Derek. I don't know what to look at. It's silly for me to look at the horse. What am I looking at? Well, other people say all the time. My wife does this with dogs. Oh, look at that dog. Isn't it beautiful? It looks like a dog, and I like dogs. Don't get me wrong; I'm not bad mouthing dogs, but you know I can't tell. And so people, oh, what a beautiful horse! It looks like the other horse I just saw. I couldn't tell a 4,000 claimer from a stakes horse. So I know my competencies, and I have faith and trust in the numbers because I do have bigger samples to draw on. And so I'm going to take faith in that. So there's no question that at least I would agree with you that if you put together, I would trust your numbers a lot more than I would somebody that say, hey, this trainer's really good at this. You know?
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time, but I want to put one crazy idea into the eyes of or the ears, not your eyes, your ears, of the handicappers out there about trainer statistics. Okay. Now just go out and try this, okay? If you're not a guy who wants to keep copious statistics and you're not buying them somewhere, just do this. In the racing form, you have the trainer results there. Don't get crazy. Just go through, and this is important, do not use the trainer's hit rate. That's a different metric. Just do this. Run through the list and with your red pen, write the total number of wins that this trainer has. And I'm assuming they still do a trainer standings type of thing. I don't use the racing form anymore. In other words, I'm not looking for national statistics on how many wins the guy has. What I want to know is something like, how does he do at this track or on this circuit or something? But take whatever you have, even if you have to do national, because even they have value. You write down the total number of wins, ignore the number of starts, and then add up the total for the field and normalize to 100%. So, in other words, what we want is the percentage of wins that each trainer has relative to the other trainers in this field. And look for, first of all, a trainer that has 60% or 50%. I don't know how to adjust this to our numbers. In our system, it starts at about 60%. But that's just a massive advantage. And that's one big leg to the table. If nothing else, look about four deep, because most of your winners are going to come from those top four rankings. And it's very doable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. So it's time for us to say goodbye. Say goodbye, Derek.
Goodbye. And I want to issue an apology to the listeners, because what did we get through, Dave? One factor?
Yeah.
Our table has one stinking leg on it. That's
yeah.
it.
We're going to change the title of this. It's going to be something like Dave and Derek. Derek and Dave talk about bridge jumpers. Derek, but you see how he doesn't follow instructions? Derek, say goodbye, Derek.
Oh, yes. Goodbye, everybody.
Still, did you hear him say goodbye, Derek? Doesn't do it. Okay. So we had a lot of fun today. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I'm sorry. Maybe we were a little too fast and loose. Derek, tell them where they can find you.
You can find me at usracing.com.
Wait a minute. That was easy. Okay, that was easy, and we're out of here.